Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher. Are you still asking your audience volunteer to stand over the trapdoor? Well, stop it. And our guest is going to tell you how. It begins in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to this regularly scheduled episode, as opposed to a randomly placed special episode of Shazam. Obviously, want to give you a big update on this past special episode, the interview with Jabrizi. There's been a lot that's happened in a short amount of time, so let me give you all of it, a big dump of information. Here's the update. So Jabrizi's episode came out. Thank you all for your emails and feedback, discussions, comments, etc. I really appreciate the sharing of perspectives and honest discussions, some of which kind of got a little heated and some had to be shut down, but I appreciate a lot of the discussions this episode sparked. So I want to address a couple of things that came up, and rightfully so, in conversation. So one, the use of the N-word being similar to the F-A word. So I do apologize for those in which this analogy hit a wrong place, and I do acknowledge that the slurs do mean totally different things and come from very different histories. I meant to reference the use and impact of the slurs are similar and of equal problematicness. Is that a word? I don't know. I hope that makes sense. More just trying to put this into a perspective for someone to understand. That, I think, is usually the most impactful way to explain something. So I do apologize if that struck a nerve for some. I totally understand your perspective is very right. And even though it's different from the perspectives that are from the people that I consulted and asked about a lot of the nitty-gritty of the episode, your perspective is completely correct. And I learned a lot. Thank you so much for being willing to share your thoughts. Two, Jabrizi is not the first person this podcast has called out, by far. He is not the first person I've emailed and invited on, and he certainly won't be the last. He just happens to have been the first person to say yes. I just wanted to be very clear that I had no intention of bringing him down or attacking him and not also calling out other people in our industry for doing similar things. This podcast will remain a place to have these conversations and to be honest about issues in the community. Again, not the first. I will continue to call out other people and invite them on the podcast. Lastly, after much research, it seems that Jabrizi was not the actual creator of Cake. He mentioned that in the episode, and I have done my best to confirm, which I think I have, but I'm not sure who actually created it. It just seems that the idea of reaching into a woman's back pockets to grab the cards wasn't Jabrizi's idea. So side note, this isn't an excuse for Jabrizi's behavior. I just think the facts are very important, which brings me back to my original issue on Cake that I mentioned in the intro into Lynn Dilley's episode. Abstract Effects has a lot more blame here than we might have understood. I originally blamed them for just releasing the effect, but there actually might be more to this. I've continued to reach out to them. I will continue to reach out to them, but I still haven't heard anything back. If anyone happens to hear anything from them, please let them know I'm trying to talk with them, and I will certainly keep you updated. So I did promise a call to action, and after much discussion with a lot of people that I really respect, and listening to you and reading your emails, I think this is what is the best course of action. I don't believe in cancel culture, but I do believe in pause culture, which is something I definitely made up like an hour ago. And sometimes people just need to take a little break to reflect and learn from an experience, and that doesn't mean that they can't ever understand or learn or grow, but it's important for them to take a step back. And I believe that we as a community also need to take a step back from him. And this is a big reason why I debated releasing the episode, as to not give more attention, clicks, stir up rumors, fuel the bundle of sticks fire, if you will. Gross. But ultimately, it needed to be released in order to spark change. Moving forward, I think we need to now act internally, not publicly. So not buying his products, clicking on his videos, asking him for conversations, unless, of course, you already are close with him, then, of course, please continue the conversation with him. That's very much appreciated. But we need to just sort of be done. And the more attention, the more he gains from it, especially in regards to money, the worse this will get. So stop talking about him, posting about him, making videos, etc. Let's just put a pause on it. Make him irrelevant in our world, and anything public is just more press. And I think, anyway, for Jabrizi, all press is good press, even if it's terrible, and you can still be a legend when your legend is born out of infamy. Of course, this is my opinion. You have full right to do whatever you want to do. I just think this is the best possible course of action. And if you want to still do something and not just nothing, I encourage you to, again, act internally. Send emails to magic companies that still carry his products and to book him. Explain your feelings and what you'd like to see internally, I think, is going to have a lot more impact, because I think it's going to have more impact where it could hurt, which is the wallet. I'm continuing to check in on the conversation. I'll continue researching and reaching out to Abstract Effects, which again, you can also do. Thank you for your help. As well, I am going to keep the door open for Jabrizi if he ever wants to talk more, even if it's just in private. The door is always open if someone is genuine and wanting to better themselves. This is why I don't believe in cancel culture. If someone really cares to learn and grow, they deserve that support. And I am very much willing to provide that if someone is genuine. Finally, I have one more bit of action. So thanks to some friends, we designed a bit of swag based off of my very silly and angry quote, "I am so much speaking," end quote, in this episode. It's so dumb. I just desperately want to be Kamala Harris. But this swag does now exist. It's on t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, and you guessed it, the skateboard. It looks really good, by the way. So there will be a link in the show notes and in our social media. 100% of the profits from this swag will be donated to the Trevor Project. If you don't want to get the swag but would like to make a donation, I'll put a link in the show notes for that as well. And all donations born out of Shazam and this swag, I'm going to match those donations up to $500. So please get on that donation so we can give a good amount of money to the Trevor Project. I think it's very important and necessary. So thank you for that. Thank you all so much for your support and your messages. It's been a really interesting few days. And after recording this, I'm going to pour some wine and take a nap because I'm very tired. Moving on, let's just get into what today is about, because our episode this week is really, really great. Ryan Kane is a magician, comedian, and author thriving in the San Francisco Bay Area. His clients include Fortune 500 companies and savvy event planners who place a high value on the experience of their guests. His book, Out of Stock, A Magician's Guide to Writing Your Own Lines, is exactly what magicians need in order to start being more original and not saying the stupid stock lines that everyone says. I have read this book. It is amazing, and I don't really say stock lines, but I still got so much out of it, and I'm really excited for you to hear this episode and also to buy the book. Please go buy Ryan's book. It is really worth your time. So let's get to it. Please welcome Ryan Kane. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Kayla. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing all right. I'm doing all right.
This is so exciting. Yay! Happy pandemic as we are recording mid-August. Mm-hmm. What fun. You currently have fire tornadoes.
We have fire tornadoes, at least one going on up here in Northern California. We have had lightning storms the last two nights. So very exciting.
Happy 2020. Who knows what's going to happen next? We could be recording this, and when it gets released, there's going to be some influx of, like, suddenly elephants are flying through the sky. And you know what? It wouldn't be a shocker.
I would take elephants flying through the sky. Sounds fantastic right now. Something in the news that makes me go, actually, I want to go see that. That sounds like a good idea.
I mean, it would only be adorable. There's probably no danger.
Yeah, I mean, right? It'd just be Dumbo, right? Except it'd probably be Disney Plus, and then you'd have to pay $30 extra to see them. So
listen, let's take a quick second out of whatever important thing we're going to talk about and talk about the most important thing, which is I'm actually kind of upset about it. I kind of get the point because you're absorbing the cost of what it would be to release in a theater. But $30 is the price of two, maybe three people. What happens to all the people that's just a single human?
Yeah, no, it was only a matter of time before microtransactions came to Disney Plus.
Thank you.
But if they are going to do that, I think they should change the plus to an asterisk.
Or just add Disney Plus dollar sign.
Yeah, Disney dollar sign is probably a good thing. Can you imagine if it was all like, if loot boxes were there, you had to like unlock your entire collection on Disney Plus?
I'd actually would love that. It's just like a big game.
What are we watching tonight, babe? I don't know. It could be Lion King. It could be can of worms for the second night in a row.
There's nothing wrong with that. What a movie. Oh, goodness. I'm glad we're on the same page. So speaking of the same page, check out that transition. You wrote a book.
Yeah, I did.
I'm going to give myself an A plus for that. So yeah, you wrote a book, which is called Out of Stock, which honestly, I typed in out of stock onto Amazon and it was very confused why I was looking for things that they didn't have. Funny. That's not true, but I just thought that would be a great joke. So obviously you're a magician. So before we even get into the book, there might be people that don't know who you are, don't know about this book. What's a quick synopsis of Ryan's career? How'd you get started? What do you do? All that jam so that people can go, oh yeah, we should pay attention.
Yeah, no, I'm totally underground. Very few people outside of the Bay Area really know who I am or the trade show scene where I work a lot more currently. Other than I bartended for like a year and a half in college, but other than that, all of my income my entire life has come from performing magic for people. Apparently that makes me a pro. So I have a background in street performing. Back when I was like 14, I used to street perform in Old Sacramento. And then that led into doing more company corporate events. I have a residency in downtown San Francisco at a small theater. And again, trade shows where I travel all over the place. So a lot of performing for real people. And I don't really go to a lot of conventions. I just do magic and do that. So.
Yeah, I think
I'm going to grab my cat who is in a cone right now.
And that's all I want.
We're trying to lick herself. And so I'm going to move her to the other room.
Oh my goodness. Okay, what no one else could see was that there was this stunning, like, brown striped cat with a cloth cone around her head.
Yeah.
That was so cute.
So she tries to like clean herself, but of course all she does is she just licks the inside of the cone and it's just very...
It's so unproductive, but it's so satisfactory.
Well, it's funny because she kind of does that already. Like that's just kind of like a nervous habit. I don't know. She just does like, we'll wake up and there'll just be like a wet spot and it's just been her like licking the couch for like an hour. So yeah, it's not helpful.
Animals are great. Everyone who's listening knows I have a dog named Bowie and he's a 70-pound pit lab mix. And one thing that I love about him, besides everything, is so he's pretty gassy. And when he needs to expel said gas, he does, but it scares him. Mm-hmm. And so we call it the gas monster because he'll just be laying down sleeping and then he'll fart and then he'll actually propel himself off the couch like it was a jet propulsion system. And it's adorable. And sometimes he needs to do that as he's getting up on the couch. And he'll actually, as he's climbing the couch, all of a sudden he'll whoom and fly. And it's great.
Why You're not? The best. I mean, I love
it. Hey,
that.
It's efficient. Yeah.
So it's efficient.
Much. Oh, I love it.
So, yeah, before that, yeah, back, that's back my background. To,
what's the point of this episode?
stock lines.
Oh, yeah.
That goes into it, though, because I was like a Gazzo clone. I used to do all the stock lines of people leaving my show early and had all this, you know, all the standard cups and balls jokes and things like that. And I was good on stage. I was a good performer. But I was really embarrassed when people come up afterwards, like, oh, my God, I love you. You're so funny. I was like, that's not my stuff. So I made a commitment several years ago, 6-7 years ago, probably, to really start systematically getting rid of the stock material in my show and replacing it with new stuff. And along that process, I learned how to write and I learned to replace all of that stuff so that now I still had that kind of like bank of lines in my head, but it's all my stuff. And it's done a lot to elevate my comedy and my show.
When you say you learned how to write, what was that particular process like? Did you take classes? Did you study under someone? Or did you just do this purely by trial and error?
I had some guidance. Scott Meltzer, who runs Comedy Industries and is the head of the Pier 39 street performer program and is a good friend of mine, wrote a series of articles for the Juggling Association. I think it's IJA. And he would make those, he probably wasn't allowed to at the time, but he would make those available to all of his friends. So we got to read them, even though we weren't IJA members. They're all free now. So you could go to his website and read them. And he really talks about, I think the first one is called like Comedy Darwinism, which is just like, how do you sit down and, or the first one was Comedy Darwinism and the second one's Comedy Creationism. And one is about like what I think most performers do of just perform and then the best jokes survive. And then Comedy Creationism, which is the harder one, is where you sit down and try to write a joke. And that's very similar to the process that I lay out of just write down ideas and pick good ones. What I did was really hone it in on stock material and that job, and then also really playing up the just comparing your own ideas to yourself, which was a little bit less of what he would talk about.
When you started changing the stock material, what did you see was the massive change? Because obviously there must have been a massive change for you to go on, oh shoot, this is how it should be. What did you see was suddenly the change in not using this stock material that wasn't yours?
Ooh, I think a big thing was when I started really analyzing the jokes that I was saying in my show, was I actually stopped doing certain jokes in situations and I would realize like, I actually don't need a joke here. So it was actually, I started doing less comedy of like, I don't need a joke for this person getting up to the bathroom if nobody sees them. I don't need to have this. That was a huge thing because so many of my stock lines were like reactionary, just reacting to the audience and things going on, which is, and also like reacting to them not reacting to me, you know, like that type of byplay where like I do a trick, oh, you guys didn't like that. I say a joke about it, then I do something else, that type of byplay. I would start to get farther away from that because I was just writing better material generally. So my jokes were getting laughs and I didn't have to have a cover line and then that be the entire relationship and that the entire premise of every trick in my show, which was my street performing show.
Did you feel like the material that you were writing that was your own was just an easier, more fun time to deliver?
Yeah, because it's mine, right? I felt prouder of it. I knew I could change it. It reflected my voice. And part of the reason, there's a lot of reasons not to do, and I use the term kind of stock lines and stolen lines rather interchangeably. It's just any joke that you didn't write falls into that kind of category. And there's a lot of reasons not to do them. It's wrong. It makes you look generic. It cheapens your entire show, right? Like even if 99% of your jokes are original that you wrote, this moment you say one stock line, anybody in your audience that recognizes that line as being stolen now has to ask themselves, well, what else did the performer steal? So it cheapens all your other stuff. But for me, the biggest thing about doing stock material, other people's material, is the lost opportunity to share something new, to create a new idea, a new joke to throw there out in the world. And then also to practice, which is what you brought up there too, of what's it like to get into this? It's practice.
Yeah, because I imagine, I think I got lucky because I hadn't really seen any magician as a kid that I really wanted to emulate. Like I wasn't a massive Copperfield clone. I was going to conventions, but I think part of that was that I wasn't seeing a woman on stage. So for me, I didn't see someone that I went, oh, I want to be them. So it was really easy for me not to go, oh yeah, stock lines, or let me use that moment because that would fit me too. And also my mentor was really diligent on making sure people didn't use stock lines and material. So I got really lucky, I think, got drilled out of that quickly. But what's cool is that you also, and we'll get into the book in a bit, but there are a couple moments in the book where I went, oh my God, I do that.
Like what? Which is, I want to know.
Oh, we'll talk about it. We'll get there. We'll get there. Don't you worry. And I wrote in your book and I was like, me, oops. I wrote oops a couple of times. Like, oh God. But I think it's so important to go. Darren Brown says this a lot, which is when you're first starting out, it's good to emulate. And I think you mentioned that in the book as well. It's like when you're first starting out, when you're a kid or when you're very new to magic, it's okay to emulate. It's okay to use similar speech patterns or use a line or feel like someone else. But you can do that to learn. But I love your line in there where it's something along the lines of, it's cute when a kid does it, but you're an adult.
Yeah.
That was my paraphrase.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like I went from reading that book every day from top to bottom, like two times. So I knew the whole thing. And then I haven't really read it in like 3 months since it's been out. So it's like, there was a time when I could quote you and you say a line, I could quote you the rest of it. There's so much to learn in magic of just understanding how to present a trick. Like if you ever teach somebody a magic trick, the first thing they struggle with is that dual track of like, there's what's actually happening and then what's supposed to be happening, and just people understanding when those are the same thing, when they aren't. Understanding how to project the voice, understanding how to make character, all of these things are so important, not to mention the sleight of hand and actually doing the darn trick that you have to learn. You can't expect somebody that's just getting into magic to also write their own material. That's just ridiculous. But yeah. not most, but a lot of magicians, anybody reading this book probably picking it up, this doesn't really apply to them, right? If you've been doing magic for 10 years, you're no longer a beginner, right? Like, you know how to do magic. If you've been doing magic and performed at the same company party 3 years in a row, you're no longer a beginner. You can learn to push yourself. If booking your show involves a tax form, you are no longer a beginner, right? Like,
yes.
you should expect it of yourself, and your audience is expecting it of you, even if they don't voice it, that you're going to create your own material. And especially if you want to elevate from like craft to art. If you're calling yourself an artist, you better not be using stock lines, mm-hmm. right? Because you need to be putting another element on there rather than just rehashing and using training wheels. Stock lines really are training wheels to get on that on-ramp of learning how to do magic.
But and comedy too.
But comedy's different, right? So if you want to get into stand-up comedy, you can't use stock lines. Like, you can't walk into an open mic and be like, hey, I'm just new to comedy, so I'm going to do Colbert's monologue from last night. Is that all right? Like, they're going to laugh you out
the
door.
I've seen that.
I've seen it too. It's so funny. Yeah, old story. But and part of that is the culture of comedy is different, right? They standardize themselves, and there's still problems, right, of people stealing jokes, mm-hmm. Et cetera, and there's always going to be conflicts of independent creation, things like
sure.
that. But there's also a ladder you have to climb in comedy, which magic has nothing like, right? Magicians get paid way too early, and that's
yes,
a problem.
Yes, they do.
Right? And so you don't have to climb up a ladder to get to this thing where you're going to have this kind of like, you can't do this because you've been stealing material, nobody's going to want to work with you. And magic doesn't have that. In fact, we have the opposite right. of it, right? You lucked out in having a mentor who steered you away from using stock stuff and stolen material. But I know and I fear that so many magician groups, when they get together to work on a trick, the attitude is very like, okay, you'll come up with your stuff eventually, but for right now, you should just do this gag, right? Like, just do this thing because it gets you in there. And like, I remember in the book, I talk about this, so like being backstage, lineup of magicians, and it was a really long show, way longer than needed to be. And I was hosting it, and I was really like, man, I really wish I had a bit right now that could get everyone to stretch and put out their arms or whatever, just to break it up. And a magician friend of mine who's been doing magic for a long time was like, oh, you should just do this bit. And I'm like, that's not mine. He's like, oh no, I know, but you'll come up with yours eventually. For now, just do this. And I'm like, no, that's not the right attitude. We got to get away from that.
Right.
No barriers to sit down and write your own get up and stretch bit so that next time I'm emceeing, I do that.
I would also mention, and kind of what I was thinking when I mentioned comedy is specifically using comedy in magic, is that if you're just starting out and you're like, oh, I'm going to identify, here are some places where talking about filling the gaps, making sure that there's engagement when usually there isn't, when the audience volunteers coming up, when you need, you know, making something boring fun that you could use a stock line to go, oh yeah, this is a place where something needs to be funny. And I don't mind that if you are in your first year of doing magic, but I agree with you is that at some point everyone needs to go, I need to elevate myself so that I can elevate magic in general.
Yeah. And I agree. If you're just getting into magic or just transitioning from like close-up magic to performing on stage, even do invisible deck and do the standard take them out of the box first stuff, because those are good jokes. Part of the reason I'm as good a performer as I am is because I did Gazzo's act, and his act is really funny and really tight. If you do every joke exactly as how he wants you to do it, the show flows. He's got a joke for every line. They're just not his and they definitely weren't mine. So
yeah. What do you think about as well doing the script from the instructions? Because I have an opinion, but I'd love to know yours and we'll have a conversation.
For a beginner, all of the above. For a beginner, go for it, because you're just learning it, right? Like, you don't know at that point what needs to be taken out or what not. And also, like, what are the instructions, right? Is this a Pop Hayden DVD that has all of the script in lines, or is it like the description in Tarbell, which is just nothing, you know? That's a big difference. I think generally speaking, and by the end of the book, I talk about the specific things to keep from patter, and it's the base exposition and plot points. But I think you should start layering in your own jokes and replacing any jokes that are in the stock thing, the mm-hmm. the patter. I hate the only time I use the term patter in the book is that chapter.
Yeah.
Don't like it. But yeah, I think you should get away from those if possible. And there's always going to be certain kind of presentations that are kind of common, but I think you should arrive at those naturally and not just do the musical chairs that magicians do with presentations where, oh, I'm going to take the recording series going to teach me a trick from Bandana Banana, and I'm just going to apply it to Sympathetic 10, which is, oh, nobody's ever done that, therefore this is original. It's not, right?
Yes.
But that's not to say you can't ever do an expose trick or you can't do the magician's insurance trick or something. It's just like you should arrive at those natural and be like, this is perfect for this. And these lines and these ideas are my own. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to push towards. And ultimately, presentations are just made up of lines.
That's right.
The biggest thing, there's a lot of stuff that got cut out of the book about like, what's the difference between a presentation and a line? And ultimately, it's just like, these are just part of the presentation. So focus on the lines. That's what's going to build up to your whole presentation. Well, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, so I stopped reading the script in the instructions because I felt myself, this was a long time ago, because I really don't buy much magic anymore, which is probably a bad thing. But if I do, I don't, even like looking back into a book, I don't look at the script for a couple of reasons. One, I don't want to be influenced by it. And two, I don't want to read it and then rely on it in a moment of going, what should I say next? Oh yeah, this is what this person in 1946 said. And
right, yeah, what, right.
Right. So I want to make sure that it sounds like my voice and I don't want to be influenced. One thing that I do, which is slightly problematic, is that if I hear something over and over and over again, I pick up on it. So when I first started touring, in the tour I'm on, most of the cast and crew are from England, and I wasn't picking up on the accent. I was picking up on the vernacular, but also the rhythm, the cadence of speaking. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped sounding like I was asking a question, and there were a lot of things. And as soon as it clicked in my head that I was doing that, I was like, oh, I got to work on that. And it's something that will just sit in my head. And all of a sudden I realize that I'm doing it. And now I have to kick the habit. It's like when you develop a new word tick. And so if I read the script from the instructions a couple of times, I find myself pulling from that when I shouldn't. So yeah. I stopped reading it a long time ago. And I feel like I can always tell, and I'm sure you can too, when a magician, they might not be using stock lines. I can tell when they're using the script word for word because every trick they do sounds different. It feels mm-hmm. different. And mm-hmm. I don't understand who they are. And because I take a lot of sketch comedy classes, and writing sketch has made me realize that this character speaks this way. This character speaks this way. And I have to make sure they sound different in order mm-hmm. for the sketch to be better. And I can now sense that in a magician, and now I can pinpoint it and go, okay, you're just using the script that this magician wrote, the script that this magician wrote. I see you. So yeah, my suggestion to people now is don't read the script. Find the places yourself where there needs to be a moment, and just don't rely on the script itself. If you read through it once to find the places where a joke or a moment is necessary, fine. But memorizing that script is like, that's boo. I have one really brilliant young girl I've been teaching over Zoom, and we're going through Tarbell right now. And right. we go through, and one of the things I say is, we're not reading the script. Go to the next place. And then she comes up with some brilliant presentation on her own because she's not influenced by that. She has her own voice.
So and this is a beginner. Somebody's great. New to magic.
Yeah, she's 10. Yeah. She's been doing magic for like 6 months.
There you go. Yeah. Well, if a 10-year-old can do it, we shouldn't be doing it either. It should be there for reference. And I think the thing you need to mine from a script are just the exposition of like, okay, I need to have somebody think of whatever, you know, to pick a card or something. Like those are the things that, and then you can change those and make them better. Some jokes that might serve misdirection. The thing that comes to mind would be Sean Farquhar's Sheer Luck, which is the memory book test, right? Which is like, mm-hmm. you would think those, that's a trick a lot of people do. How do you take that and then strip it down to make it original? That's a tough challenge, but is something you could do to just cut out all of his jokes, mm-hmm. right? And figure out, what are you doing with this? I've seen that presented not as a memory thing. I've seen that presented in different ways. So if that's a prop that appeals to you, and maybe that's the difference too, Kayla, is I think you and I are at a point where we look at a new routine And it's like, I see the pieces and I don't see the holes. Like, I like that piece, and that piece is never a joke or a presentation. That piece is always mechanical or like plot of like, I like where this situation gets me. So then I don't care about the script because all I want is this one moment and I have other ideas for it.
Right. Yeah, but also that comes from so much experience, which is why I totally agree with you that it's okay at first, or if you're just a very, very hobbyist magician and you're using the script or stock lines or stolen material for performing at your family's yearly talent show. Like, I'm not mad about it. You're performing at your magic club, fine. I'm not mad about it. But once you start moving into the realm of wanting respect from your audience, I think then that's where you have to work for that respect.
100%. It's about setting a new standard for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think also helping to change the culture of magic so that we, as a collective sorority fraternity, can move beyond this being normalized, right? Like the fact that people use stock lines and FISM and it's a magic castle is why?
Yeah.
We can't tell these people like, no, we can't tell them, no, don't say out the clean. I'm taking the dollar off every stock line you say.
Thank you. One of my favorite things is to go to the castle, especially with bringing someone that maybe hasn't seen a lot of magic, but is a good friend of mine, knows that I'll go on soapboxes regularly. So they know what they're in for. And to take them to me.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I should just rant and rave on a podcast for an hour a week. Oops. Oh, please still listen. I love taking them to like three different performers, and they will see either the same trick in every show, which could also be once in close up, once in parlor, once in the palace. That's happened. And it's been like three fly, which doesn't make any sense to me to do it. Like, that can't work for every venue, and it doesn't. And then to see them do the same jokes, the same script, it'll be word for word the same. My friends eventually will be like, I think we just saw this. Whereas my very first week performing at the castle, three of the performers did a borrowed bill to Impossible Location. But we all did it completely differently. Now, I'm not just saying one of us did it to a banana, one of us did it to a lemon. Like, no, no, no. They were completely different, to where I think I got told one time, oh, I saw somebody upstairs did it. I like yours better. That doesn't mean that mine was better, but that was the one moment somebody went, oh, those are the same tricks. It was so cool to go, oh yeah, the three of us are so different. I have such a unique point of view on things that it was okay. We did the same under the umbrella term of object to impossible location trick because they were totally different. And that I think is what, especially if you think you are at the Magic Castle booking level, whatever that might be, if you're charging money, totally. I love your point. If you have a tax form, get rid of these lines.
Yeah. And I think what you said there, having a different point of view, that's what people crave in any art, media, anything, right? And the easiest way to add new point of view to your show is just write your own lines. That's the easiest thing. And I think that's all the audience expects of you. And if you're repeating old jokes from vaudeville, old ideas from vaudeville, old ideas out of Tarbell, right? Like, what are you really providing new? And so you can take a routine such as Bill to Impossible Location or Sucker Silk to Egg. And as long as you provide a different point of view, how do you look at this? You can make it something new and then people can accept it. I still think it's better if you're doing new tricks, but also like, I'm not a great inventor and I do classics and I don't mind that. Not everyone's going to be able to do that, but I think everyone can sit down to at least write your own lines. You can brute force it out. And that's what I advocate in the book. And that's why the book exists, because I've never seen a book like this that really laser focused in on this specific issue, really as a doorway into bigger issues of just taking greater accountability for what you say on stage and what you're presenting. But that's what it does. And it systematically goes through and allows you to clean out your show of these things.
Yeah. Well, what a great transition into the book, because that's what we're here to discuss. I'm holding it up for you. There's no point to holding this up right now. So as mentioned, I read it cover to cover because I wanted to make sure that I knew what your perspective was on so many things before we actually had a conversation. So first of all, thank you for the Shazam shout out. That was cool.
Of course, I got
really excited to see the podcast in the book.
I've been listening to this since your first episode, and I was like I talked about this all the time because I thought you and Carissa were doing such good work. So,
thank you.
I'm a huge fan of the podcast. I have obviously some different opinions on some things that I talk about in the book, but I always am like, hey, listen to this. And I tell, you know, all sorts of stuff. And you've interviewed a lot of my friends. So it's always great to.
Yeah. I also really liked your perspective too on specifically the part where you mentioned Shazam on the use of pronouns, because I'm also very happy. I actually like your perspective a lot, which is going, is it time for everyone to jump on this train? And you say no, and I respect that opinion a lot, which I think is great. I personally have had experiences where I had an audience member say that they were really, and I never mentioned, there will be no pronoun, like I don't make an announcement, but an audience member and their friends came up and said, this is the first show where I haven't been misgendered. So thank you. And they were crying. And I was like, oh yeah, this is important to me. And yeah, I understand. That's also very specific to the location. It was in Chicago. So that's a really specific thing to the location. And I'm very happy. I think you didn't want to agree 100%. I think that's totally awesome.
And, I mean, to clarify my position a little bit more, which is I don't think it's the right time for the type of show I do, where I involve so many people and I'm constantly making side jokes to people. I will say this, virtual shows, I use far less pronouns because I can't do it as much.
So I'm
already starting to see that weave out. And when we do finally get to perform live again, I think there will be probably a different time. And also it'll be another year. So yeah, I think when I do sets where I'm not interacting with anybody, or I know the pronouns of every character I'm talking about because they're fictional or whatever in my own thing,
right,
I don't use pronouns generally. So I do think that is the great ideal. But also I think for some mentalist, it's probably really, really hard to do. You know, like if I'm doing tossed out deck, here, pass that to that woman there. That to me seems to be a faster way to indicate where it's going to, rather than say a nickname, like, you know, calling someone Red or saying fanny pack or Nike or whatever based upon what they're wearing, which I think puts more emphasis on choices that they've made here. I don't know. But and also just the humor of there too. It's funnier to say, you know, except for this man here rather than this person here. It's just that much better.
Cleaner. Sure.
And I also change a lot. I'm in the Bay Area, right? So if I'm performing in Berkeley, I'm probably not using some of that joke. And I actually will choose to do the lesser funny joke of saying person rather than the punchline man or whatever.
Yeah.
Punchline.
Yeah, you know your audience.
Yeah, if you're in Sacramento, I don't think the pronoun thing is nearly as big of an issue. And that's still California.
For sure. But also you mentioned, which I think is really smart, which I think we can totally agree on, is just use the name of the person.
Yeah.
Or I like how you also say that you give them characters. So instead of using their name, if you forget their name later on in the show, you have a character name for them, which I think is really smart. And I think that's awesome. I think every performer at this point can say, I have accidentally called someone a man when they're a woman, or vice versa, or whatever it is. I think a lot of performers could say, oops, I made that mistake, especially with like kids. That's the one time I did it, is I called up a kid and thought it was a boy, but it was a girl.
The biggest part where I have found that I do start shifting to those pronouns is with kids for two reasons. One, I really, really, really am concerned with not misgendering a child. If I'm going to misgender someone, I'd rather take the risk on misgendering a grown adult rather than a child, right? Because that's a big thing. The only time I use pronouns are for one-off things where it's like, you know, I'm making a joke to this person or something, or it's like, hand that to her, et cetera. And even then, if it's not specifying a person of like, I need you to hand that prop to that person surrounded in an audience, I would just say, hand it to them, right? But I just use names as best I can, and I add titles to them. So somebody will be called Inspector Todd. So
that I love that.
I call them that. Did you catch the subtle joke on that?
Inspector Todd?
Tossed out decks, so it's Todd.
I didn't get it, but now that you say it, I love it.
Which is how it's been in my script for years. So he's always been Inspector Todd. So I do that. But if I do forget the person's name, I can just call them the inspector and it's fine because I do recall them multiple times in the show.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
It's so, also easier on Zoom because you can see people's names. So if you're doing a virtual show, you can just see people.
Yeah, so helpful, right? Yep, agreed. I really like that section too, because I think, again, like all opinions are great if you can back them up. So I think it's awesome, except for one, and I'm a little bit of a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
Because of this book. There's one thing that I need to correct you on and you need to agree.
Okay.
I love that you mentioned Celine Dion, but her first song was not Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And I literally wrote down, no.
Do you know her first song?
Yes, in French it is called It Was Only a Dream. I can't pronounce it in French. It's beautiful. Her brother and her mother helped her write it. It was the first song she ever recorded, and it's not Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. So next print, if you could correct that, I'd really appreciate it.
I mean, I meant that as that's the first song she would have sang as like a child. But all right, yeah, I can change that. I will.
She was 11 when she was recorded. So boom.
I stand corrected.
Thank you. Anyway, moving on. I was reading this like we were in bed reading, and I just went, oh no. And my partner heard it, and was like, okay. And I was like, I mean, this is great. Celine Dion made this book, and I am very happy. This is wrong.
People are like, why is this book about stock material talking about Celine Dion?
No, because it's important. Like, you should, you can use every aspect of Celine Dion to give an example. At least I do. And
the context of the book is how the book is laid out. There's like writing sections where I talk about the base thing about how to write. And then there's also essays between each one that are just general performance things. And this one comes from a part where I talk about general presentations, but I think we should move beyond.
Yeah.
And that being, this is my first magic trick.
I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so really, actually someone on Facebook, David Grimm, I think is referencing the idea of doing a first trick bit. And tell me what you think. But for me, if you go, this is the first trick I ever did. Well, gosh, weren't you a child? This isn't going to be impressive. Yeah. Everybody has their first trick. Like, literally, I think everybody in the world has done one magic trick. And for the most part, it's the 21 freaking card trick. And nobody wants to watch that again. Now, if your first trick is flying, then we have a different story.
Right.
But it's
boring. Even then, it implies that a child could do it.
Yes.
You know, there's an angle for all of those ugly sweaters, as I call them, that could work. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, if it was like, I have been working on this trick since I was a kid. This is how I used to do it, but this is what I do now. Or like, there is a story arc that can make it work, and et cetera.
Yeah.
Or even just as a throw, there are ways, but as like a whole presentation for a trick that isn't your first trick, such as six card repeat or whatever. No, just leave that behind right there. That's kind of my view on it.
Yeah, I really agree. I also really love how you structured the book in terms of, here's the core information, and then here are my little tangents that still stem from the core of the information. And I like that with the ugly sweaters bit. And I also like how you end each section with this very abrupt, strange transition where you're like, why are you going to get a snack? Oh, I get it. I get the next page. I get it. That made me laugh out loud in multiple situations. Like, not only is this book informative and interesting, but also funny. So I was laughing. Like, this is great.
I joke that the book tells you to put it down because it tells you to, like, put the book down to go write. But unfortunately, me being me, I write it so that you can't put it down. And most people do blow through it in like 2 hours. The book went up like a Friday night. And then the next morning I had people posting about it online saying, you know, Chris Carter ran on. I was like, I read this last night. It's great. You know?
Oh, so great.
It's just kind of cool that that's how people approach it. So.
Yeah, it's really great. So I'd like to just grab a couple of points in the book that really resonated with me, that obviously is important to you as well because it's in here.
Sure.
And then kind of discuss that level. So starting out on kind of a fun thing, I want to talk about audio recording every show. So oddly enough, we had the same idea separately, which is I bought an Apple Watch specifically to audio record every show. Mm-hmm. And that was a big game changer for me to be like, oh, I'm funny here, not here. Why did I say that? Ooh, there's a lot of dead time with nothing going on in this moment. It's brilliant. So what led you to go, oh yeah, Apple Watch, this app? But
My girlfriend got me an Apple Watch. I just wanted one for just basic stuff. Like it's just easier.
Yeah.
And then Thomas John, who is a fantastic juggler out of Canada, we and I do one gig together, the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk, which we both utilize to create new material. And he would use that app. So the app is called Just Press Record. There's other apps like it, but it's just the one I use. And it's like $5 or something. And it's just amazing. I just put it on my watch and I actually don't wear my watch anymore because I'm indoors all day. So like,
yeah, same. What's the point? I don't want anybody contacting me right now.
Yeah. But I would just, you know, hit that and then you auto record every show. And so then you could listen back. The boardwalk is you do 15 minute shows and then you have like an hour between them. Well, you technically have 2 hours, but they alternate. So we would listen to our show, both watch my show, listen to my show, walk to the other stage, sit down, listen back, or just talk about it and then write new stuff, change it. He do his show, we do this, and we just do this for like a week at a time.
Nice.
And I missed that gig. I'd be there today, I think. I was supposed to be there. Sweaty shows for like nobody because it's hot, but but man, was it great to try out new material. I'm a big fan of finding places where it's hard to do good material, because then if you know you find stuff that works there, you know it'll kill anywhere else.
Yep.
The other thing I want to talk about on Apple Watch, which is great, is this is also how you can apply this method to walk around. So where you don't have a camera or anything else, you can, hey, I want to see how well my intro joke for my walk around set is. Just do that, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that was the thing that got me, not so much about the walk around, but the fact that because I move a lot when I perform, which is potentially to my detriment, but I have fun. So I move a lot. I dance. Like there's just a lot. I'm just like an outwardly expressive person. And what I realized is that I would set up my phone or an audio recorder amongst my props. And then you couldn't hear anything I said because I was so far away and I didn't plan that. And having the Apple Watch right on your wrist is so brilliant. Yeah. And that was seriously like the next morning I would listen to it back. And you know how magicians have laugh ears or magic ears, whoever coined that term, everyone knew, who knows, maybe Mac King, maybe Max Maven, someone will fight and figure it out. But that idea of going, oh, I killed it. It was perfect. Murdered. I'm the best. And really the audience wasn't into it at all. I'm the opposite. So I walk off stage and go, oh, God, that was awful. They hate me. Absolutely hate me. That was awful. I'm quitting. I'm just out of here. And so the next morning while recovering from wine, then I'll go, all right, let me listen to that. Okay. Actually, it either was as bad as I thought, but it rarely is. It's okay. That was better than I thought. Still tweaks, but that's good. And so then that reminds me, don't quit yet. So I think that was also really helpful for, of course, tweaking purposes, but also to ground myself in the reality of the actual reaction the audience was giving was really helpful to my brain.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think a lot of performers recognize that they should record things, but then nobody listens to them.
Back.
Yeah, I think that's massive. And whenever I'm doing new material, I cannot remember anything. So every time I do like a new thing, and I try to be in what I think of as like uncharted waters for as short as spurts as possible. But man, if I'm doing a new sequence or a new joke, I have no idea how it went. So I have to listen to it back to even know how it worked. And I do this on virtual shows too, where I just record and then I watch every little screen. I pause right as I see one person react because I know that that's when it's gotten to them. And you see how many people are laughing. And it takes longer than just being able to listen to it because you got to go back and look at everybody. But
right
today.
Yeah, but also I think that's really smart because I had a big conversation with Richard Weissman on this topic where he was like, you want the reaction to happen to everybody at about the same time because then it will have an exponential growth. Because if you react, but the person next to you isn't reacting, then you're like, oh, am I not supposed to be reacting? Did I just do a wrong thing? And so when both of you react, then you feed off of each other. Mm-hmm. So the idea of magic trickling over the audience is usually not the best idea, but the same is with laughter, is that if it's a slow burn laugh, then it feels longer, but actually it's longer, I think, to the detriment of the moment, of the performer. And so having that where you can go, okay, how did this work? What did this sound like? Watching the video and going, okay, this section laughed first, then that person, then over here, you go, ooh, okay, how do I get that to everybody?
Yeah, and sometimes it's, when you start analyzing your own babies of your own jokes mm-hmm. that you put out there, sometimes you keep some that only hit a certain audience. I do a lot of topical things that I drop into my show, and I recognize that that's always going to be for people that literally saw the news today, because it's usually like an additional punchline. And I don't wait for that laugh. I just throw it out there. But if it is a joke where it's like, I need this to get a laugh and it's not working, yeah, the slow burns, you never want to pause and wait for people to get it. Very few jokes, that's the proper thing. It's probably just better to rewrite that joke or jettison it entirely.
Yeah, because oftentimes laughter can be used as misdirection. And if it's a slow trickle over the audience, you're only misdirecting part of the audience for part of the time.
Well, yeah, but if the context of the joke, why that joke is in your show, is misdirection, like that joke's got to be good.
Yeah.
Because it's serving a functional, a methodological purpose in the trick.
Yeah, for sure. Another section, so this is my admission time, which is one of the parts of the book that I was like, oh, I do that, is the, all right, let's try this. Let's try this something. So I think what you write about in the book too, which is really cool, is that magicians say that so that it feels organic and improv-y. And for me, it's because I have no idea what I'm doing next. So I'm actually going, no, what am I doing? Let's try this. And it's very much in like a certain atmosphere, not in the full show. But
yeah.
When I read that, I went, oh, it does make me look unprepared and unprofessional. Cutting it. And I had never thought about that perspective. I think that's really smart.
Yeah, I think if you're gonna be performing, particularly like you or I, in a professional setup where it's like, oh, we've hired this performer or they're coming to see your show, like you should know what's going on. You shouldn't be like, all right, well, what do we do? You know what? Let's try this. It's like, what are you doing? Who's buying into this? And if they are buying into it, is that the image you want to do? I mean, obviously, there's character motivations that negate both this and the first trick, right? There's a character out there that, you know, a savant's character, whatever, like this is my first trick. That might work. But what I'm talking here is that the stock version of this that magicians just slap on, that part really hits mentalists who want to portray it as being real, and nobody's buying into that. You look pathetic.
Yes. So I have a rough theory that is, when I say it's rough, I mean, it's rough because I want to like hone being able to explain this more. But it's this idea that an audience comes into a show and automatically you have a certain level of points when they buy the ticket. So you might start at, like, your goal is 100 points or more, right? But 100 points, that's the best possible show. And when the audience buys the ticket, if the ticket is a little too expensive or they didn't get the seat they want, you go down in points. There's traffic, you go down in points. They can't find parking, you go down in points. You walk out on stage and you don't look good. You don't say, like, whatever it is, you go down in points. You're late, like all of this stuff happens. You'll go down a point. And if you get like a 60, that's a fine show. People aren't going to be mad about having a 60 in there. But your goal is to do the best possible show ever. And so I love saying when you go, oh, let's try this, and it feels like you're unprepared, you get knocked down a couple of points. And it's not going to ruin the show. People won't remember you said that, but it will go in their brain as, oh, did they not know what was coming? Tick, tick, tick down. And then you have to fight to bring those points back up, as opposed to being able to fight to go from where you were and get more points.
Every time you're saying, let's try this, or what should we do next, is a moment that you could be spent doing something engaging.
Yeah.
Right. There's an opportunity cost to everything you say and do on stage. And I love what you bring up, particularly if you are producing your own shows, virtual shows even, of you have to take accountability for their entire process. So how clean the theater is, how easy was the ticket buying process? You mentioned a ticket being too expensive. I think a ticket being too cheap is also their thing. Totally. I have reviews on mine that are like, we didn't expect much based on the ticket price. And then it was like better than we thought. So that actually helped them, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that type of like goodwill things. There's also like a friend of mine's girlfriend talks about this a lot when she goes to see shows, of people sit down and then they set the standard really fast. Oh, this is going to be good. And then that's the standard.
Yeah.
Or they sit down and say, all right, this is what it is. That's the standard. And, or it could be bad. And then that's when you start really getting a lot more hecklers and people trying to entertain themselves and stuff like that. If you're bad, that's why you're getting heckled, is because what you're saying is boring. And so the audiences are trying to make this thing better for you. you obviously want to do a perfect 1000 show. How do you do that? Well, you got to take care of all of these things, and you've got to make sure that you don't have these little things such as saying, oh, what's the next thing? Or, you know, like just get into stuff. I'm so big about just cutting transitional stuff. I'm editing a friend's script right now. He's paying me to do that. And it's like, I'm just, well, there's like, this is filler. We don't need this. We don't need this. We don't need this. Granted, a lot of that's not going to go through. Like, I don't have my scripts perfectly memorized. They get to that point after doing them long enough. But when I'm creating something, it's not just like, because it's too fluid to commit to that. It's, I've got my main points and then we can go from there. But then once you start getting your polished routine, my bullet catch paintball routine, for example, there's not much fat in that trick anymore. Like, I know how to get everywhere and I know the exact clarity that I need to communicate to somebody a particular idea without, you know, stand here, do this. And it's very tight because I do listen to it. And I was like, I don't like that line. Let's get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can communicate a lot with the words that you say, but I think a lot of people forget that you can communicate just as much in silence. You can communicate your feeling, your reaction, direction, as opposed to going, please go stand over there. You could literally just point. Everyone understands what this means, right? Or if something happens, one of my biggest pet peeves magicians do is saying, I'm so mad. Well, I don't believe you for a hot second that you're mad.
Yeah.
But if you stand there with a you can tell you're grinding your teeth. Yeah. That's how mad you are. That is convincing to me. You don't have to say anything. Just be mad. And mm-hmm. I think that is something that magicians will try to put in a line or two to explain what they're thinking or feeling. Whereas you can just do it in silence or say your script over communicating something physically. 100%. I like doing that a lot where I'm having them do something. Or mm-hmm. I'm writing down a prediction as I'm giving my script. You can do two things at once.
Yeah. You can show that you're not sure about this prediction.
Yes.
Without saying, I'm not sure this might be. It's like, that. This is filler. It doesn't do anything. It's so much more effective to have that subtext or that thought, that motivation and stuff. Have the audience connect things. That's what it is. A good joke is the audience connecting things in their mind. A good magic trick is them connecting things in their mind. You got to get them right to that edge and then let them do that. That's the fun of engagement. That's the fun of entertainment right there. Doc Hilford has this great routine called the time machine where the coin goes back and the whole idea is like the spectator goes back in time in the journey and grabs a quarter and changes play and it's brilliant. And then he says, I think you went back in time and switched the quarters. And I hated it. It's as soon as you say that, it's done, right? You got to get them straight up to that line and then be like, oh my God, that's what's happening. My whole show right now, my virtual show, is this massive subtext that is never said out loud. And everything's tied together, but I never say it out loud because then you're ruined. So what can you communicate without saying something? As much as it's about rewriting lines, you can also rewrite lines by just not having them and doing something else. When I bring someone on stage, I normally don't say stand right here. I just indicate and look, and I know that they're going to do that. And as soon as I see they're moving, then I can go up, right? And usually address the audience while they're going there because that's filling this time. And then I can turn back to them downstage so they face me, and then I can back in and face out. So we're cheating out.
Yep.
Because people don't know how to stand on stage.
Sure. Yeah. But that's part of, as the professionals, we can help them with that, but we can also help them with that without explaining it 16 different times and wasting minutes.
Right. Well, that takes 2 seconds and it achieves everything without saying a word. I can actually be talking to the audience, saying a joke and filling that time with something interesting while I'm getting my audience member in the correct location.
Yeah. You mentioned hecklers a couple of minutes ago and I want you to explain it, but I also want to mention that the way you explain it in the book is the way I've been trying to explain it for so long, but didn't do a good job. I would just tell people what I was thinking, but not as succinctly. Mm-hmm. Oh, words. Succinctly. Gross. Chris, keep it all in. you explain it well.
Thank you. Words.
And you explain it in now a way that I can go, oh, that's what I should have been saying this whole time. Can you explain your view on hecklers? What do magicians mean when they talk about hecklers? Mm-hmm. And how are they wrong?
Right. Yeah. And hopefully I can explain it as well as I did in the
book. I'll help you.
Yeah, we can do that. essentially, I think a lot of magicians are too quick to label someone as a heckler. And I used it previously, just kind of colloquially, which doesn't actually apply to my viewpoint of it, which is, I think most heckling is simply unwanted interaction. It comes in multiple different forms of people just saying something because you set them up or they're not convinced of this particular odd thing, right? So it's like, oh, the cards, you know, maybe it might be methodological. Difficult words.
We're having a hard time talking today.
It might be methodological of, hold out, take your card, right? And hold it there. I was like, well, can I look at it? That is not them trying to mess up the trick. They're trying to make the trick as good for them as possible because you haven't convinced them and you did the bad thing of saying an outright lie that could be challenged. That's a good way to not get heckled is just don't ever lie about it in state.
Right.
And then the other attitude is like people saying jokes or calling things out, right? Like if you set yourself up for a perfect, that's what she said joke, and somebody shouts out, that's what she said, you can't really blame them for that, especially in walk around, because walk around is like half conversation, half performance. So people just want to interact and want to be a real person and want to engage with you. And the last thing I'll say on this is people that think that the point of a magic show is for this two-way street. A roommate in college, I was doing a show and he sat in the back and just constantly shouted stuff out and like do things. And afterwards I was like, what are you doing? He's like, dude, I was helping you. I was making the show better. And he legitimately thought that. He legitimately thought that this was what is expected and that he was helping the show. He wasn't. So a lot of it can be about educating and understanding why is this particular person doing whatever they're doing right now. You have to figure that out, and then you have to respond correctly. And then the last thing, I don't think I even say this in the book, is if you are gonna like get harsh with a heckler, try to shut them down, the audience has to understand that they're gonna be a problem, that they are a problem. So a lot of times as a performer, we say, oh, this is gonna be a problem in 3 minutes when they keep doing it. I'm gonna shut them down now. To the rest of the audience, that's just interacting. Right? They're still just doing what they still think are the rules of the show. So everyone else in the audience has to be like, wow, can that person just shut up before they're going to stand for you shutting that person up in any capacity or asking them to be quiet, even kindly. So,
yeah, I have 3 stories based on everything you were saying that will just say, oh yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
One is the idea of if the audience thinks you lied, they'll call you out on it because they do feel like in an intimate setting, this is a two-way street. And my story recently was I was doing an online show and I use a wine bottle as a prop. And I mentioned that the wine is vegan, which it is, which is important to me as a vegan. And so I mentioned it's, and somebody in the comments said, all wine is vegan. And I went for 45 seconds on like, not all wine is vegan. Let me explain. And then went on, they called me out because they thought I was lying. And I wasn't, I was telling the truth and I was certain to go on a tangent for too long, totally too long, but fun for me. But also that shows, one, I know what I'm talking about. I didn't lie, which means people will be less quick to go, oh, she's a liar, which is good. But if I get caught in a lie, then everything I do is a lie. So we got to make sure the audience doesn't feel that. Needs to feel truthful, even though it's not sometimes, right? An ordinary deck is usually not an ordinary deck, which is why I hate
it. And it's not what anybody calls anything. So,
right. But two, that was a gift from the audience. They weren't heckling me.
Right.
They were calling me out on what they thought was bull. They realized it wasn't. And then it ended up being funny and fun.
Right.
And then that's a gift. So I, and they're calling out by going, yes.
Yeah. Look,
it's kind of a yes, but that's kind of the idea, just to like correct myself.
I think that that's a great story. And also gets with the virtual show, this whole other world of like, now we have chat to deal with, where it's not just people shouting things out and kind of this aside of like, that's probably somebody that they wouldn't shout that out during a show, a live show. They probably just lean over and whisper it to whoever they're with.
Right.
And also I think you have to be unaware that in a magic show online, everyone's private chatting and doing stuff and going on mute to talk to each other. You just have to accept this now.
Yes.
I don't know the right way to respond to the public things.
Well, I think what was important to me, and this might be wrong, but I kept the chat up during the show. And if people were just commenting on like, where's everybody from? Okay, whatever. Like, maybe I'm not as engaging over a screen as I wanted to be. But also, I can't help it. We need to have something else going on. I mean, while we've been talking, I'm playing with a fidget cube because that's just what I need to do to focus. Fine. But I think what was cool is that I like and I thrive and my show is better if the audience gives me gifts. I want them to do that. So when someone in the chat says something like that, I want to respond. And I will say, Michael, no, you know, like whatever it is. I want it to feel like there's a genuine interaction. And I watched back the footage and I was like, okay, I see what I did wrong, but I see what I did right. What was better about that is that it made it feel like you're a part of it. And it's not a pre-recorded segment. You're not watching television. This is a show.
Yeah.
You are still here with me.
Which for virtual shows is the whole selling point. That's the whole reason that this is existing and you got to capitalize on it. And it's great that you listened and said, here's a situation I haven't experienced quite before.
Yeah.
This is what I did. I like these aspects of what I did. Here's the things I don't like. So next time something like this pops up, you get better. And the reason you did that is you listened back and went through. It's like, oh, you know what? Mm-hmm. I was too harsh on that, or that didn't get a laugh, or I stayed on this too long, right? That's how you get better. And that's how, again, on stage, I feel very fluid and like I'm reacting to a million things. That's only because I've been in a lot of situations and I've sat down to write situations and I've analyzed them. So I have that Rolodex of lines in my head. And I'm slowly building that for virtual environments. I'm slowly building that for my lecture. So I start having jokes for my lecture now.
Yeah.
Because the more you do it, it's just listening back. You're like, oh, that was weird. Okay, I need a joke for if there's no questions. I need a joke for if someone's getting off mute. I have a joke for if somebody is backlit and they look like a silhouette, right? Like, I have a joke for that. So it's about sitting down to create that.
Yeah, I think magicians are too quick to label someone a heckler because they don't know how to handle the interaction. And if you don't know how to handle the interaction, then like you said, it's unwanted. It's the audience's fault. And actually, I think it's the opposite. I think it's the magician's fault if you aren't able to go with the flow. Because these are people and they are going to do something stupid at some point. Stupid being a good stupid, not actually dumb.
Yeah. If you're the performer on stage, you're responsible for the show. Yeah. And I was at a comedy club, opened my thing, and the host was woefully inexperienced. And a couple performers came out and did really bad offense. It was like an open mic, so it was like really, really rough. And there was like a big altercation with somebody calling up and the C word was thrown around. And, everyone looked to the performer on stage. And I felt bad for him, but I'm also like, this is your job. And he handled it terribly. And so you do accept that sort of response. That's not going to happen. I've never had something like that on stage, but it does fall to you as the performer on stage. If you're going to take that microphone and say, hey, everybody look at me for a little bit, that's a certain responsibility. And you've got to accept that everything that's going to happen, even the feedback to you, such as that's what she said jokes, right? If you're going to lead or homophobic jokes, if you're going to lead something where then an audience member is going to say a joke that you don't want in your show, but you set them up for that, that's your fault, actually. I think that's your fault as a performer. So,
yeah, I really agree. There's a great story. I was not there for this. There's a story from the castle where Jeff McBride was performing in the close-up room. And he was performing.
By the way, just real fast.
Go
ahead.
Jeff
McBride is such a fantastic host. And it blew me away when I saw him host at the Palace one time. And see, I think of him as just like, oh, you know, he's got this great act and he's got the school and stuff. Man, was the guy. I learned so much from watching him. Sorry, just counterpoint to my other bad host idea.
I love it. I love it.
Yes, go ahead.
So he was performing in the close-up room, and I actually quite like a lot of his close-up show versus most of the other material he has. And one of the reasons is that he's much more present and organic in his close-up show. And then he goes into the Bravo character, and he's mid-Benson Bowl routine with a mask on. As this,
it's like the Commedia dell'arte thing, right?
Correct. Yeah. And someone in the room fell over from a heart attack.
Wow.
And now this is the story. Like I said, I wasn't there, but he did not break character. He handled it as Bravo. He went out, got the, you know, everything. He kept everybody entertained while they were waiting to get the guy, like, okay, out of the room. And the guy was fine. And then Jeff kept going with the show. And it was like, well, see, that's someone who's done a couple hundred shows this year. Like, that is a, he was in it. And I thought that was a really awesome story to go, like, he could have just gone, oh no, okay, show's over, we're out. Well, yeah, I would have been like, oh my God, okay, everybody, you know, and just handled it. But you're in control, you're driving the bus.
Yeah.
And if somebody on the back of the bus is having a heart attack, you need to decide what to do. Are you going to keep going? Are you going to pull over to handle it and then keep going? Like, what's the deal? And I thought that was so cool as he kept in character, handled it as Bravo would, but also safely, and then continued on with the show. And I was like, oh my goodness, that is a pro.
Wow. That's right. Amazing.
And that's not like a gift, but that's also not a heck.
No, it's not.
That's
a gift.
Like, no, that is a.
I think the all wine is vegan and a heart attack are pretty much the same thing as
totally.
Far as
I'm confused on why someone would disagree with that. I think the thing as well is like the overall rule is we need to live in the present moment in every show we do. So every word, every moment, everything needs to be handled presently. Listening is like, that is a big pet peeve of mine of magicians, that they don't listen. And it's also a pet peeve of mine with stand-ups, that they don't listen to the audience. Something happens, again, somebody shouts out, that's what she said. Oh, I mean, give that person a high five or something. Like, yes, they, wow, they deserve an award. Yeah. You know, something, just listening and living presently in your act is something that not enough of us do.
So yeah, I agree. And I could be better at that because I do,
same.
I do get in the, I'm just blowing through this and I don't know where I'm going. But I also think that there's a certain viewer that would hear that and interpret that in a way I think neither of us want, which is, oh, you don't need a script. You can just vibe.
Good point.
And live in the moment, right? Which I don't think is right. And I will even go to this far of like, you can't really be in the moment if you're trying to think up stuff and just trying to vibe. You have to have a structure. Even if the structure is, and again, coming from, I just created 45 minutes of brand new material over the past 2.5 months. Of, you know, when I'm trying this stuff out, it's usually like I have an intro joke sequence for the top. I know this major thing and this is it. And I'm going to kind of flub to get between these. But like I have a structure. I know where I'm going. I know the tone. I know these jokes. I know the trick. That's enough to get it out there. And rather than just say, okay, I'm just going to do this trick and I have no idea what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And now that I've been doing this material longer, it's solidifying into a script incredibly rapidly. I haven't created this much new stuff in a long time. And creating material is so difficult. Why on earth you would ever try to do it live and on stage in front of an audience is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. And thank you for bringing that up because I think that's a really good point. And that's definitely not what we mean. It's more of the idea of you have your script. Like you can't put the plumbing in a house if you haven't built the foundation, right? Metaphor. So So I think that's exactly right, is you have to have the foundation, you have to have the structure before you can add in the plumbing, the electrical, all of that. And then once you have that structure, once you have that script, it's okay to divert and come back to it when you're living presently.
And you're better prepared. You can make better decisions in the moment, knowing what the show normally is, to be like, oh, this person made this joke earlier, or this thing, this happened earlier. I'm actually going to, instead of doing my normal punchline here, I'm going to do a callback to that.
Yeah.
You just made your show so much better.
Right.
And I just got chills thinking about that. I don't know why. I miss being on stage.
I know. Yeah, we're talking. We're literally just having moments of going, I wish I would make these mistakes. I wish I had that opportunity right now because at least I'd be on a stage.
Yeah. Because a lot of people are always like, oh, I don't want to feel too locked into a script. You're not locked in. You can change. Nobody's.
Yeah.
No, you don't have a stage manager off. Well, you might with Champions of Magic and touring. Then you have like you.
Different game.
Driven on things. But generally speaking, most people listening or reading this book, you can change whatever you want. You can abandon anything. And it's about having that structure. So then you can decide this is a better course. This isn't a better course. This is a better ad lib than my normal line for the situation. And that's also how you come up with new lines listening to your show. So then it's like, that was better than my normal thing. This goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to the Tools of the Trade segment. In this segment, I want to tell you about different tools, resources, etc., that will help you gain more knowledge, look and feel more professional, or a product that needs more attention because it fits within the Shazam mission. And I'm very excited to tell you about all the fun things I found on the market. You should also know that, much like all the other segments, no one is asking me to push any specific product. All sponsors of segments know that I have complete control over what actually gets talked about because it needs to fit within what I feel is important through the Shazam podcast. So that being said, our sponsor for the Tools of the Trade segment is The Magic Apple, the magic store on the second floor in Studio City. The first product I want to tell you about is actually the product that made me want to do this segment, which is D. Christopher's Razor Wallet. So this Razor Wallet is actually a peak wallet that has a lot of different applications. Yes, it's a peak wallet, so you can have someone write something down or put it in your wallet and you can see what they wrote, see the number on their license, whatever it is. But it also can be used as a reveal. It's not just for mentalism. It has a lot of different applications. But the main thing I want to mention, which I think is the most important thing about this product, is that it's completely gender neutral. So it's not a big bulky wallet. It's not a trifold. It's not made of brown leather or anything. It is a very, very thin wallet, hence the razor wallet. It can fit in your back pocket, as small as your pocket might be. It can fit in a clutch bag. It can fit absolutely anywhere. And that is included in magic bags and whatever you happen to be carrying around. It can be used as your normal wallet, but it also comes in two colors, black and crimson. And the crimson is not a very girly pink. And I say girly, meaning the societal standard of girly. It's just a beautiful color crimson. That's the one I have. I love this product so much. I can't wait to use it in person again one day. It's brilliant. It has so many applications, but that gender neutrality of the product being what I think is the first purposefully gender neutral wallet on the market, it's awesome. I really highly recommend picking one up for when you start to do live shows again, hopefully in the future. This is a great, great tool. And if you want to grab D. Christopher's Razor Wallet, in either color, you can go to www.themagicapple.com and use the coupon code SHEZAM, that's all capitals, S-H-E-Z-A-M, and get 20% off your entire order, which includes the Razor Wallet. So go do that. Thank you so much to The Magic Apple for sponsoring this segment. There you go.
Hi friends, Richard Young here from the Magicians Podcast. I'm just stopping by to let you know about a brand new amazing project I've been working on, which I'm finally able to share with you. It's not a podcast. It's actually an amazing magic gimmick that creates the most incredible visual change of a playing card ever conceived. And there are dozens of applications for this new gimmick, as the face of the card can change up to, believe it or not, 4 times. We have face changes, back colour changes, cards that go blank in midair, and loads of others too. We can even make customised cards that you dream up, as the possibilities are endless. There are some fascinating untapped uses for mentalism too. Visit the website right now to see the trailer, changingcards.com. That's changingcards.com.
Our Books to Read segment this week is brought to you by A Bunch of Books, the Eli Marks Mystery Series. The book I want to tell you about is actually more than one book. It's a comic book series called Hocus Pocus. It's an ongoing series about magic, history, psychology, and the paranormal. It's created by our good friend Richard Weissman, along with comic book legends Rid Worth and Jordan Culver. It's pretty awesome. I have the first 2 issues. The first one is all about mind reading, and the second one is all about seances. So the comic book features in a really fun and funny and entertaining way different people throughout the history of magic on these topics. So 3 or 4 different really famous historical mind readers, as well as people who either ran seances or would bust seances. And what's really cool is that both issues so far feature a very prominent story about a woman. So it's really cool. And I'm really excited to tell you all about it. Definitely go check out this comic book series. There's a lot more coming, as well as you can get a free download of it right now. So we're going to link to the website in the show notes. Definitely check it out. It's hocuspocuscomic.squarespace.com. This segment was sponsored by the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Master illusionist Jim Steinmeier had this to say about the series: a wonderfully engaging, delightfully tricky bit of mystery. Fans of magic will delight in the artful use of the world of magic on stage and off stage. It's a great story and great fun. You can pick up the first book in the series, The Ambitious Card, for just 99 cents. So go grab your copy now at elimarksmysteries.com. That's E-L-I-M-A-R-K-S mysteries.com. The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. This week's awesome historical woman is June Horowitz. June was born in 1913. Her dad was a magician, and although he taught all of his children magic, she was the only one of her siblings to stick with magic on any level of professional. She actually met her husband using magic, and there was some story, according to the American Museum of Magic, involving, quote, sleight of hand and a sugar cube, end quote, which sounds like a very fun way to meet a spouse. June put herself through school with magic and became a math teacher. She often used magic to teach math, and many of her students went on to being magicians semi-professionally or professionally themselves. She was awarded Best Female Magician by the Magic Gals Organization. The Magic Gals Organization was a somewhat short-lived magic organization of only women in magic. She worked with the League of Women Voters. She served on the board of the Welcome Home for the Blind. She was involved in Mensa. She was on the board of the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods and taught on subjects of Judaism to other faiths in the community. She was very active in the International Brotherhood of Magicians and was actually the first female president in 1987. Unfortunately, June died in 2018, but she certainly lives on with all of her work and many people she has inspired. This segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Every week, if you listen to the Penguin Magic Podcast, you get a 25% discount code on our featured download of the week, and you can hear stories from your favorite magicians behind the scenes at Penguin and save money on some of the best new magic. Visit podcast.penguinmagic.com to take a listen.
I want to talk super briefly about tribute acts, because...
You really love that chapter.
Yeah, I did. I really did. It's so, I wrote so much in that chapter. I was like, yes, this is great.
I love that you're an active reader, by the way. That's fantastic.
Oh, I have to, because I won't remember anything. Just really fast, can you talk about why you think everyone should do a tribute act to Di Vernon?
Oh, yes.
I'm just kidding. Everyone.
Yeah, so defining the term tribute act, I talk about where a performer talks about Houdini, Max Mellini, Di Verno, whatever, and says, this is my tribute to this performer. And I argue that I've actually had multiple people. My brother had a problem with this section, and also my editor had a problem with this section.
But really?
I kept it in. Yeah. My argument is nobody in the audience cares about this. So as a base presentation, I will bring up my brother's point, which is actually interesting. But I want to talk about what it is. Nobody cares about, like, Houdini to most people is just a name. They don't really know. He's been dead for 100 years. They know the idea. They know the mystique. But like, if you're saying I'm doing a trick by Houdini, nobody knows what that original trick is. It hasn't impacted their life. So right. Your spin on it doesn't matter as much as Maroon 5 doing a tribute to the Beatles. You've heard Maroon 5 music. You know the Beatles. Music impacts your life every day. So this is interesting and makes sense. And also, Maroon 5 are an important band where what they're doing, that's a statement that matters in the world. As opposed to, like myself, you know, if you see me at any Pier 39 or at your company event or whatever, it's like, who cares what this guy thinks about this dead Di Vernon character? So that's why I think the tribute as a presentation is dumb. Again, general thing. You know, we did Fox City Magic Fest, did a whole thing about Daryl, where everyone did a Daryl trick, unfortunately, after he passed away. That makes sense.
Yeah. It
doesn't make sense if you're just doing a fair festival show. And I think that's a lazy presentation.
And to add to that, I'd say when you tell me that there was this guy named Erdenes and he created all this amazing stuff and now I'm going to do some of Erdenes' material, well, my head goes to, well, you're not going to do as good of a job as the guy you just built up. I want to see that guy. And now I don't give a crap about what you're doing because it's not going to live up to the standards that you've just set for yourself. So I loved that a lot where I was like, yes, finally someone else is talking about this other than just me and Harrison all day long.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Robert Strong, who's a magician, has a rule of don't ever mention another magician in your show. Why are you talking about another magician? The example that my brother brought up that he thought falsified that statement was in my bullet catch. I talk about Chung Ling Su and I talk about Robert Houdon. I don't mention them by name. I actually call them other things. So it's just like there was a dude and it's kind of the thing. But the trick is not a tribute to either of those people. I talk about how I think this is the most significant magic trick in all of human history because it prevented a war and it's killed people and stuff, right?
Right.
So it's, this is why I am doing this trick. And here's some examples of that, which I think skirts that line where it's like, okay, technically, I still don't think it's a tribute. It's not a tribute.
Right? I agree.
And again, I don't break my rule because I don't call them by name. I make fun of them and...
Yeah. But also I think the fact that you're like, so I just want to mention that someone died from this next thing. So let's try it. You know, then boom, you've got some extra danger. And yeah, I agree with you. I think
that flows well in the fact that I start talking about Chung Ling Su that, you know, I mean, the line is there was a dude who blah, 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 blah. And he actually died doing the trick I'm about to do, incidentally. And then I talk about him. And then I say, and then another guy used the same trick, not to take life, but to prevent the loss of life by preventing a war. So it's a nice contrast. So, and it's, I've actually found, I used to cut that monologue a lot, and I found that more recently, I don't really do the trick unless I do that monologue to see this is why I'm doing it. It's also not the finale of my show anymore. I used to be my finale. Now it's like the second thing.
Oh, cool.
Two reasons. One, Alan Wakeling's thing of like, how do you build a new show? Take your closer and open with it. And then the second thing is if my entire show was the bullet catch, then the whole show is the gun show, which is not what I want to be doing right now. But if you move it up and it's just like, oh, here's an effect and here's an interesting thing and it's hyper polished and some of the best comedy I've written, to put that up front is like, all right, where are we going from here?
Yeah, I love it. So let's play a fun little doohickey game. Yeah. Couple of people, mainly Rob Balchunas. In every episode, Rob Balchunas has taken part. So now I make sure that he is in every single episode asking a question because he's great. So I just asked people what the stock lines they've heard a bunch are. And so I figured you have a massive process to rewrite a stock line, but I think people should just buy the book because it's too extensive. Like we could do three episodes about the process of rewriting the stock line. Or just buy the book and it's the same thing. So I figured you and I could just have some fun, seriously or not seriously, rewriting some of the stock lines some people mentioned. Sound good?
Sure, yeah. Do you have one you want to start with or?
Yeah, so starting with some Rob Balchunas fun, let's do the clean hand bit.
Fun, yeah.
Can I have your hand know the clean one?
Yeah, 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 which I just rewrote this for a lecture the other day. So the basic process is once you find a stock line that you want to get rid of is you would convert this into a context, meaning why did you steal this joke? What does this joke accomplish in your show specifically? So for the clean hand joke, the context is simply you need the audience member to hold out their hand and then that's a boring thing. This is a more fun thing to make that work. So if you want to rewrite this joke, what you do is you write 10 new ideas. And if the word funny or joke is intimidating to you, just think of them as interesting. 10 interesting ideas to get an audience member to hold out their hand. And then of those 10, you pick the one that's the funniest, because one will always be the funniest. Creativity is just relative. Once you present yourself with 10 ideas, then you're just like, oh, this one's good. This one, most of these are bad, but this one's actually decent. And then you can work with that. And that's how you get to a new joke. So it's kind of hard to do rapid fire here, but it is a process that I have done. Yeah, I found the ones I already did.
Great.
So the idea is you would sit down and write out a bunch of different things, but have you thought about this at all? Or do you, I can try to wing it off.
Yeah, I think the one I would do that's very my personality is I would say, can you hold out your hand? And also like motion that, and then I'd give them a big high five and then go, okay, now hold out your other one.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that was just, that's very which me. I love. Can you hold your hand? Bam, that was just for me. Okay, now for the trick, right? Like that's a great idea. Yeah, a lot of times what I do is I do put myself into the action of like what I'm doing there. So it's like, hey, can you hold out your hand? Maybe just like lower and just do this to get him at the right spot.
Like move your hand a bunch. Yeah.
Yeah. That's idea one. Actually, that's idea two for our list. Some of the other ones I did was like, are you right handed or left handed? So right hand's your dominant hand. Okay. Hold out your submissive hand. That's idea three.
We both said some, so we can go to the next one.
Yeah. So those are really quick. And again, I like yours that come up with that right off the bat. Pick another one. Let's do this.
Yeah. I also like, maybe we can identify the problem and then we can both write the thing. Cause I like your idea of going, here's the problem that comes with it. Let's do two or three more. So we have Chris, who's our editor, said, what about all the you should applaud lines? The,
right.
Either you don't get applause or you just feel like you need to say,
all of
this
the,
is where
all
you
of the
applaud.
Cover lines, which all fall into the same thing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks. One full applaud. Or do you want me to tell them the jokes are coming when they've already been, that type of thing.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Yeah. Actually, let's pause here real quick and talk about, do you always need this type of stock line? Sometimes you need this. I think you should have a couple in your repertoire just for when you get that moment where something that should get applause really doesn't. It's like, whoa, what happened? Also, don't plan for that, right? Like, if you're keeping a joke in your show because it sets you up for a great follow-up cover line, just get rid of the original joke or write something better and save your cover lines for when stuff unexpectedly does fail.
Mm.
But yeah, so I can, like, my immediate thought off of I say a joke and it bombs is just like, okay, cool, yeah. That brings me back to some dark times. Thanks for that, right? And then continuing on. That's idea one.
Yeah.
Idea two would actually stocks. I'm not even going to throw that on the page. That's the rule for this is like, don't edit yourself here. Just throw them out on the page. And then also the only thing is make sure it is your idea. So don't put down ideas that aren't. The goal is to get to 10.
Great.
Do you have one?
If what I did didn't get applause or I didn't get a laugh, I think I'd just make a funny face and then high five myself.
Great,
I'm going to talk a lot about high fiving. I'm much more of a funny face physical kind of person. Yeah. So that's probably where I would go.
Yeah. And I do lines as not just a joke, but an action in response. For a lot of times, it's just a look, right? You know, like, they're getting a joke. I just, you know, like that type of glancing at an invisible podcast group is great.
I think acknowledging the fact that it didn't go well is absolutely fine.
Yeah, just acknowledging it.
But you also acknowledge, okay, that was on me, as opposed to going, why aren't you laughing? Yeah.
Well, great. That's another thing. It's like that person thought it was hilarious. Just that person, right? And just point to whoever did laugh at the joke or something. That's idea four.
Yeah, great. How about the line, this isn't TV, I can hear you, which is another belchiness.
Yeah, so that's similar to the other one, but it is more inclined to train the audience to clap is what I would say. I used to use that. In case you didn't know, this is a live show. It's happening. I'm actually here right now. It's kind of what I think about that. I guess that's a little bit different, but that's what I thought of when I first read that on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like the context of how do you write a joke to train the audience to clap, which I think is huge. So idea one is like, everyone hold up your hand like this, hold up your other hand, go like this, bam, cool.
Yes.
That's idea one. In my show, I do a thing, like if it's cold, I was like, hey, everyone just real quick, do this. Like if it's cold in an outdoor show, I was like, yeah, it warms you up, doesn't it? Yeah, do that as much as you'd like, right?
Yeah.
In virtual shows I've been doing, if you really like the show, hit that clap emoji. Or if you see something that you like, hit that clap emoji. If you really like something, stand up while you click it. is what I've been using.
That's fun. Yeah. I don't know. I think for me, this line doesn't make any sense to say if they're not reacting. Because if they're not reacting, maybe you just need more energy. And you could fix that internally instead. Where I can see using this line more is if a spectator and like a group of friends is talking.
Oh, right. Yes.
You know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes.
And
gotcha.
I feel like for me, at least that's where I can see myself putting this in as like a backup. And so if that were the case, I don't know what I think I would just be like, well, what you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And this comes into the step we're kind of skipping in the process of writing down not only the stock line in your show, but also what happens beforehand, which right.
If there's a group of people talking, I don't want to humiliate them, but also why are they talking and not paying attention to me? I feel like this is, and this is the same when people are on their phone. It's probably on my end. Maybe I need to be more entertaining. And so I'll just do the teacher thing, which is I'll just kind of walk in their direction and look at them to interrupt them. And it doesn't shame them. It just kind of goes, oh yeah, she's a person in front of me. I should pay attention. Yeah. And then if they keep doing it, then, you know, we have a problem. But usually that teacher tactic makes it go away right away.
Yeah. It also kind of falls in that heckler unwanted thing of what is going on? Is somebody having a heart attack? Does somebody have somebody in the, like, you don't know. And obviously you would expect someone to allow that to take place to text message or to excuse yourself, but you never know. So it's kind of like, I notice is a problem. And very often just a look can't do that, even if they're on the phone looking at somebody who's next to them.
Yeah.
And just being like this and like doing the eye contact there can do that.
This is something that happens in bar shows a lot, is that people will just be talking and you know what? Yeah. You just kind of get used to fixing it without interrupting your show. You just fix it by reminding them you're there without shaming them or making it feel like that show is stalling. And then you're fine.
And I would probably refer to that later. You know, I would probably let it go for a little bit to let the audience know this is annoying to me. And then if it went away, like they just finished talking or whatever and hung up, and then I did like a big moment of magic, I might replace my normal follow-up. It's like, that was so good, she even got off her phone.
Yeah,
which then
yeah.
solidifies backwards into, and again, there's a use of me using a pronoun mm-hmm. because I think that's mm-hmm. funnier than saying this person or they. It's easier to specify because then everyone
knows what I'm talking about.
But again, that can go out the window and I'm running a tightrope where I know I'm going to misgender someone.
Sure. Let's do one more. This is actually one that Rob and I have had kind of a deeper discussion on, and we did some investigating, and I said, I'm going to save this to talk to Ryan about it, which is the line, what's your name? That was my name when I was a little girl, said by a guy.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the history of it.
So I'll tell you what our discussion was. This is honestly a thing Rob asked, texted me, so giving credit where credit is due. He texted me and goes, is that line transphobic? And I went, do you know what? I've never thought about it. We should ask. So we did. And we asked people who are transgendered saying, is this line offensive? And they all said yes.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I went, oh my gosh, that's not something I thought about before. And I get the purpose of that line is to go, let's make asking somebody's name fun, right? But yes, it ends up not being fun. So how do we then rewrite that?
Yeah. So this is a good thing to talk about, looking at context of the entire context of that is just getting somebody's name is boring and mundane and predictable. And this is an interesting way to do that. This is not a joke about what you used to be as a person. It's not a joke about gender. It's just a joke. Right. So that opens it up to any million ways to ask somebody, what is their name? Right. Mm-hmm. So my first thing would be like, what would you like to be called this evening, right? And maybe you do that in like a silly voice. That's idea one, right?
Yeah.
I also think that's another thing to go, and I have a whole section in the book about names of what do you want people to be called on virtual shows. If I see somebody, like you're right now, Kayla and Harris in Zoom. So I would probably, this is what I would do. I'd say, hello, Kayla and Harris is Zoom. And then can you unmute yourself, right? Where you talk, it's like, Kayla and Harris is Zoom. Do you have something else you'd like to be called or something? And whatever they care, I don't care what you want to be called. That's what I'm calling.
Yeah.
So figuring that out, right? What would your title be? And again, this would be done to a child too. So here's another idea. It's like, oh, what do your friends call you? Okay, great. Do you like what your friends call you that? You know, like, and maybe there's some punchline down that thread that might be funny.
Yeah.
Because the goal here isn't to create the funniest joke right now. It's to get a list and then find this is the one that's the most interesting, most unique, most fully fleshed out. And then we start working on that and polishing it up to find the right punchline, the right structure. But you've got to present yourself with those ideas. And before that, you've got to identify the spots where they belong and what they should be about.
I mean, this line just shouldn't exist anymore. I didn't think about that it was wrong, but it is wrong from the people who it targets unintentionally, but it does. Yeah. So it needs to go away. And honestly, I actually think names are cool. So I've never felt there needs to be a moment in going, let's make asking someone's name fun. I think it's cool to be like, what's your name? Oh, say it one more time. Wow, that's cool. That's a great name. All right. And, you know, repeating it a couple of times so that they hear it. But also there's no point in making fun of names or making it feel like this is a moment. I think you just get the name and move along.
Yeah. And you've read the book. I'm not a big fan of making fun of people's names or that type of thing. And I would still say I would lean towards if you can have a good joke for that initial interaction, I'd rather have it. But it's also like, you might not need it.
Yeah.
But it's better to have something there than to not. Because the interaction of what's your name, Amelie, okay, Amelie, do this, could be better by saying, what's your name, Amelie? Ha, funny, that's not punching at them, not offending anybody. There's an ideal there that could be aimed for and reached, which is what I would try to do. But
Also,
it's interesting you said, oh, I don't think this line should exist about that specific one. My whole viewpoint is like, I don't think any stock line should exist anymore. We should it's a stock line. Get rid of it. I don't care. I don't care how funny it is. Get rid of it.
Yeah. Yep.
It's not just the transphobic ones. So.
This has been so great. Can you just give everyone the quick information? Where can they find you on the internet? And then where can they buy your book?
I am at Ryan Kane Magic, RyanKane Magic. That's Kane with a K, like Citizen Kane or not Citizen Kane. It doesn't matter to me.
Great.
And I do kind of a silly Instagram series called Tips and Tricks with Ryan Kane. So you can follow on there and see me writing jokes probably faster than I should. The book is called Out of Stock, A Magician's Guide to Writing Your Own Lines by Ryan Kane. It is on Amazon. The ebook is $10. The paperback is $16. You can search for it there, RyanKaneMagic.com. And I also run if you're doing virtual shows and want to get stage time, I run the Mostly Magicians virtual open mic, which happens every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific. Signups are at 5. That is a Facebook group. If you join it, you can learn about that. And that is how I've slowly been able to record shows and get better and learn new material.
And we'll link to everything in the show notes as well. So it'll all be there. But definitely buy the book because it's great. The fact that I read it tells you that. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks,
bye. So. And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at SheZamPod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shout-outs in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/SheZamPod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the Society of American Magicians and the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Thank you to the SAM and the IBM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.